Let me just introduce very shortly, because most of the proper introduction is actually in Robert's presentation. So this is Robert McNamee from University of Oxford, and he's a director of two important projects for us. One of them is called Electronic Enlightenment, the other is Oxford Tech's Archive, and both will be explained a little bit later what they are about. And Robert is definitely coming from a perspective slightly unusual for this seminar, from the very literary side of science, and we don't do that much literary computing, but there is, and I think it will be visible, there is obvious space for interaction with natural language processing, and hopefully we'll see where that space is in the presentation and how we could collaborate with their work. So now I give the floor to Robert.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Beautiful city. Nice to have summer. I hope you'll indulge me for starting with a very personal overture. It's a very personal project in a number of ways, both in terms of its creation and operation, but also in the content that it works with, which are very personal letters of a range of people. So I think it's really important to think about, see if I can get this working right. Did it turn off? Oh, is it? You do indeed, okay. Just to say something about the background, it's an envelope of a letter from Voltaire to Monsieur Lepin, who is the king's clockmaker. Voltaire wanted to, always a man for an eye to the opportunity, he wanted to set up a watchmaking factory in Ferney-Voltaire, and he was trying to steal the king's watchmaker to come and work for him. So as I say, it's a very personal history intersecting with the project. We deal with correspondences, letters between people of all types and ranges of time and space, as it were. So because there are correspondences, both in the project creation and its content, I was going to give you a little bit of background about how I came to be interested in correspondence. My family went west with the Northwest Mounted Police in 1874. They'd been sent out to knock down the American forts that were being built selling whiskey to the natives. And this isn't that far in the past. Chief Two Young Men was, he and his son were friends of my father. My father, who was a teacher, helped them set up one of the first schools to teach Stony Cree, Mountain Cree, to the young people. And of course, letters were a major part of keeping in contact and keeping the community together. That's the first schoolhouse. It's also the oldest building in Western Canada. It's on my uncle's farm. It's only about 150, less than 200 years old. It's not my mother, but it stands for my mother. My mother was an inveterate letter writer, wrote huge numbers of letters all year round. And the letters coming in, my family were quite religious, and they did a lot of supporting of missions and things around the world. So letters were coming from all over the world, from China, from Africa, from India, and so forth. And my mother, over the course of time, went blind, and I just discovered this coincidence. Eduard Zerm, who's from Olomouc, is it? Near Prague, did the first successful human cornea transplant. It didn't survive particularly long until it was developed by Dr. Castroviejo in New York City. My mother was the first person to have lifelong sight based on corneal transplants. Just an interesting coincidence as we're going along. But When I got ready for university, because I was living in Western Canada, the basic view was that you couldn't study literature if you were male. You had to go into the sciences. So I ended up working on reading astrophysics and working on a project with the ISS-2 satellite. And we produced the first view from space of the Aurora Borealis. Thinking of communication of information, as the satellite passed over Goddard Space Flight Center in Maryland, it would beam down the data, which would then be transported to the University of Calgary, which, as you can see, is a six-hour flight if it was by plane. But our form of the internet was Greyhound Bus, which sent the paper tapes to us to reprocess on a computer that's one Pi, Raspberry Pi, is about 32,000 times more powerful than that PDP-8 that we used in those days. I got tired of working in an office with a computer and went into the ski business and ran a ski resort for 8 years, which is important because one of the concepts of our, one of the dimensions, significant dimensions of our project is involvement in commercial operations. But I heard myself quoting Plato to my staff at one point on the ski resort, and that triggered my idea of going back to college. So I went back to study literature, but I'm not sure whether you know, but certainly in Canadian schools at the time, no one taught us the instability of texts, the variety of manuscripts that survived. So I went to British Columbia, the University of British Columbia, paid for my university by off-season ice road trucking. I don't know if you've ever seen that show. And did medieval studies and cinema, as you can do in North American universities. Particular emphasis on Dante and Tarkovsky, if you can imagine. And then was offered a place at Lincoln College in Oxford, where I began doing textual studies with Professor Don McKenzie, looking at the history of texts, manifestations in manuscript and print, the variants and variations of it. I continued to sit in on physics lectures at Oxford because I was interested in maintaining that connection. And amongst the guest lecturers who came to talk one time was Tim Berners-Lee. And I don't know what kind of turnouts you get for somebody like that, but in Oxford, it's very common to have a small turnout. There were only about half a dozen of us came to hear him talk because he'd come to talk about this thing he was creating, the World Wide Web. And it got me thinking about how correspondence was a very much like this interconnectivity of texts. At the same time, I began to work on the Canterbury Tales project. I don't know if you know anything about that, but it was looking at doing an electronic transcription of every manifest manuscript of the Canterbury Tales. There's 84 of them, and doing textual analysis. Through them, I was put in touch with the Voltaire Foundation, which is the major French 18th century institute in Europe, probably in the world, based at Oxford, publishing Voltaire's complete works. And in the course of that, I began to work with Cambridge, with ProQuest at Cambridge, on creating what was called Voltaire Electronique. And one of the things that was of particular interest were the range of works that Voltaire wrote, which we created an SGML DTD to cover every type of material, including his correspondence. The project has been converted into XML and sits on the University of Chicago Library website now. But I was intrigued to discover that the foundation had vast quantities both of the original documents and also the printed publications of correspondence, focused entirely on the French 18th century, which is why the project that I developed was called Electronic Enlightenment. The first HTML manifestation that I created was in July 1997. Oops. This is a letter Madame de Graffigny to her friend Devaux. So that material was simply keyed in HTML and tagged by hand. But in the process, I created an XML version not long after the specification was recommended by W3C. And we created actually an XML DTD that would cover every literary genre, so it was quite an experiment. We photocopied the books. The Voltaire itself had 50 volumes. We photocopied the books and sent the photocopies to India by boat, basically. When I had completed the photocopying at a company in Oxford, when I went to pick them up, they said, don't ever come back again. So we had a considerable problem before anybody had introduced bulk scanning of books. I'm sad to say that most of the books on my bookshelf now have been cut because we run them through bulk scanning. So I began the Electronic Enlightenment Project in about 1995, really, the first version, and received 6 Mellon grants to spend time thinking about it and develop the project. And then in 2008, I moved the project to the Bodleian Library because I saw that it was much broader in concept than just the French 18th century. One of the things that the Mellon Foundation insisted on The ambition of the project was to create a web of correspondence with the notion that nodes within those webs would refer to particular texts, particular people, particular events, that we could make connections, although they didn't exist at the time, but we could make connections imaginatively to digital texts or digital manifestations of some sort of that are referred to, and thereby rebuild in an interesting way a much more complex view of the world. One of the additional points that we've ended up doing is we're creating the history of ordinary people. So someone like Voltaire, he has 1,250 correspondents, many of whom are not people that would normally get published, but exist now. There's a whole collection of letters by tripe sellers in Paris who ask for Voltaire's help with the government over a legal issue. At the moment, the project online has a range of structures to the data, and of particular interest perhaps for computational terms is that we've got 40 million words in the project, about half and half English and French, although there's more besides that. What the Mellon insisted on is they hired a business consultant for us for 6 months to look at how you build a self-sustainable project in the humanities, or in anything else, I suppose. Something that's more common, I suppose, in the sciences, where you spin out a company of some sort to generate income. They wanted to know if we could develop a project that would be able to maintain ourselves. And as I say, the project is 20 years old this year. We rent space from the library, although the project belongs to the library, the Bodleian Library. We pay them for space. We pay our own fees, our own salaries. We pay for imaging and text capture in the Far East. So we've been able to maintain, and we for the material that is licensed, we also pay a royalty or a license fee to those publishers that provide the content. At the same time, there's lots of material that's free, and we're able to put, and we're in the process of developing a project in England for a group that have got funding that requires that the access to their content be freely available for at least 5 years, and we can do the same thing there. So this is one of the things that often seems odd and unusual about our project, but I have to say it's been a huge benefit to us, and Mellon were quite clever in seeing that we should try and create something like this. Along the way, as well as material for our own project development, we've been able to offer increasing amounts of support to students, scholarships and bursaries. And as I say, we've offered free-to-view publication as well. So nothing that goes into EE has to be behind a subscription wall. One of the other things we've been able to do is we've been able to support research access, providing downloads, big data downloads of the content for individual researchers. And also the University de Réunion, as an example, are working on an edition of the works of Bernardin de Saint-Pierre. We have the only collection of his correspondence, and they get free access to that so they can make references to the correspondence in their edition. And of course, having subscribers isn't something new. Lists of subscribers appear in printed books almost from the beginning of print. Sourcing our data comes from printed scholarly editions. We also have historical editions. This publication of Voltaire's letters in translation caused Voltaire to begin one of the first legal challenges about authors' rights in Europe. And increasingly, we've got academics working directly from archives, transcribing manuscripts, editing the manuscripts, and inserting their manuscript selections into our development list for imaging. Sometimes transcription can be difficult. This is a letter by Laura Galloni to Mary Wollstonecraft, and to save paper, she cross-writes. I don't know whether you've run across that before, but cross-writing the letter, so writing left to right, then turning the page and writing left to right across the writing. Rousseau was particularly bad at doing that because he would turn the paper partway and do it at an angle as well over top of it, which makes it incredibly difficult to transcribe and also a bit difficult to do automated transcription. The files that are submitted to us can be hand-coded text files with the most basic of tagging. We also developed some styles for Word documents, and I've just had a big collection of letters, data captured in XML in India, and they did that in about a week and a half per volume. When the material comes back, we've got a selection of editorial databases. We use FileMaker Pro. We began with them simply because our project was supported by Apple early on. We had a lot of kit and software. But it's turned out to be quite useful for students and editorial teams because they find it easier to work with than most other databases. The databases have, as I notes here, an XML element is equal basically to a FileMaker field. We do a huge amount of the editorial processing and interconnecting in those databases. And I think a point of particular interest is the number of distinct data points to check for each letter, which is everything from dates, which are broken down into a complete date structure, and we created our own calendar for the Julian and Gregorian and French revolutionary calendaring systems. Annotations for the letters have five levels: authorial, textual, editorial, language, and general remarks. If anybody wants to ask a question or something at some point, please interrupt and do so. Envelope information, address, postmark, and endorsement are all captured separately. Unfortunately, in a lot of historical editions, and even in manuscript archives, they didn't preserve information about the envelopes. By and large, envelopes don't appear in most manuscript collections, which is a real shame. So, in this particular Graffigny letter, the one I mentioned earlier, that was the first one that I did in HTML 1.2, just the bibliographical database has 518 data points that need to be checked or filled in. So we have, Gregorian date structure, which automatically generates the Julian date structure, or vice versa. If we have just the Julian, it automatically generates the Gregorian, as well as the French Republican. We even have the Republican calendar in Basque, because the student I had working for us at the time was quite interested in that. The manuscript reference has, again, a huge number of data points. And we standardized the data, the reference to things like the Yale University Library Beinecke Rare Book Manuscript Collection. And we have a separate archive database that controls information about where that is, actual address information. So there's opportunities to develop all kinds of further links and connections. Each person has dozens of, hundreds of data structure elements that need to be filled in. And we've begun the process of cross-referencing to other people, either within their family or other people of significance within the group. The XML is then, the data is all exported from our editing database in XML format, put into MySQL, which then generates the web pages. Additionally, we do all sorts of things, such as creating MARC records. One of my ideas, which has been a bit of a headache, is the idea of generating MARC records for people who aren't authors of books. So traditionally, the MARC record system is a way of cataloging authors of books and probably runs your libraries as it does everybody else's. My idea was that we should treat people who are authors of correspondence the same way. And we've been able to create several thousand unique identifiers that way. So we're updating the VF and the Library of Congress authority name list as we go. In many cases, EE offers the most complete collection of somebody's correspondence available. The Adam Smith, for instance, in EE, we have the OUP, the Oxford University Press edition. We have half a dozen letters that appeared after that edition in scholarly journals, from economics journals to a German philosophical journal. We've also got 20 letters that were recently provided to Cambridge University Library, which were bought at a sale. The New York Public Library has bought manuscripts for us in auction and provided them to us. So we've almost doubled with Adam Smith. We've almost doubled the number of known letters that are available. And it's not available anywhere else at the moment. Last year, I took on the Oxford Text Archive. The Oxford Text Archive is one of the oldest digital projects around. It was meant to be a store of digital research that was completed, particularly in the United Kingdom. One of the things they recognized very quickly is they had to archive software to run the projects. Then they had to archive hardware to run the software to maintain accessibility to the project. And The government pulled its funding on it, but it was maintained by the university. And I moved it to the Bodleian Library, as I say, a year and a half, 2 years ago. And with the help of certain people in Prague, we've begun to create a new full-text repository with subject classifications. That will be going live by the end of next month. One of the particularly interesting collections within the Oxford Text Archive, it contains things like the British National Corpus and a number of legacy projects. But the Text Creation Partnership titles, EBO, which is Early English Books Online, ECHO, 18th Century Collections Online, and Evans, which are American publications, are all based on the English Short Title Catalog, which lists every book published in England or America or in English in other countries from the 1400s through to 1800. And they're gradually being keyed into XML by people in Michigan and Oxford. We've got just over 61,000 full titles in at the moment. We've got another 100,000 over the next 2 years. At the moment, that offers something which was in my mind when I took on the Oxford Text Archive. I've always imagined, as I said earlier, this notion of correspondence as having links to key texts. And this seemed to me to be a prime opportunity to do that. And by the end of this year, we'll launch a new collaborative project, Lives, Letters, and Works, which will connect the two together. So in Electronic Enlightenment, in the letters, we have about 40 million words. And the OTA full text, based on the English Short Title Catalog, has 1.5 billion words. Should be enough for linguists to do something interesting with. Oops, come on. So at the moment, we're looking at authors in the Electronic Enlightenment's bio-dictionary, linking to letters in Electronic Enlightenment, linking to works in the Oxford Text Archive. And we've just completed, and you can find online, 350 of our people linked to 4,000 works. So for example, for Robert Boyle, if we search in Lives for Robert Boyle, Biographical Dictionary throws up the biography of Boyle. Just out of interest, the correspondence list, 418 people. One of his main colleagues that we're just beginning to data capture is Henry Oldenburg, who with Boyle created the Royal Society for the Sciences in England. And when that's done, we'll link that with the Philosophical Transactions published by the Royal Society. A couple of thousand letters, but it also includes 65 of his works now, including The Skeptical Chemist, or Chemical Physical Doubts and Paradoxes. These are in the full text version of the Oxford Text Archive, and one of the things we want to be able to develop is a way of paginating that material so you get very specific reference links to the location of a quotation. That's the text in the old Oxford Text Archive, which will be looking somewhat different by the end of the month. So it's scholarly as well as technical, but there's lots of areas for people to help in identifying and linking and building connections for things. One of the difficult things, and one of the things we want to be able to produce dynamically, is name form change by time, for instance, where titled people acquire a new title over time as probably their father dies. But there's also disconnecting, disambiguating people like the Marquis d'Argenson, which, as you can see, is got a very complicated set of slight variants. And one of the problems that we run across, because every person in the project has a unique identifier, we have to identify that specific person, even if they have the same name. So if you have John Smith and a John Smith and a John Smith, we have to find ways and means of distinguishing those to link to our unique identifier so that all the links and connections begin to work. This takes a huge amount of time and effort. Also, locations, name changes. We have a relationship with the Getty Thesaurus of Geographical Place Names, which has about 12 million place names and variants. We capture, although we present everything arbitrarily at the moment in modern form, we capture every variant we can come up with, linking them to the Getty Thesaurus. So the searching on any form of the name will throw up the same collection. One of the things I'd like to be able to distinguish were locations for unlocated letters. There's quite a few letters, thousands of letters, which don't have either a source location for writing or a destination location. But we might be able to do something programmatically if we looked at where people were on particular days and generate a heat map, if nothing else, of where they were more likely to be. We tried this with one document, and amazingly, I didn't expect this would work, but one of the things I imagined happening is that, again, it would happen to be Voltaire, his movement from Paris to Ferney. And the heat map suggested that he went through particular towns, and we had somebody go and look in the archives, and they found actually a letter which reported on his visit, and him with a company of friends putting on a performance of one of his plays 10 years before anybody thought the play actually had been produced. We have quite a few letters that have place names that nobody has been able to recognize until, what was it, about 3 years ago, and an academic colleague in Paris bought a map of the postal routes in France in the 18th century, and were able to identify that there were post stops nowhere near towns, so these post stops had names of their own, and those names appeared in the letters. But we didn't know about them. Nobody else knew about them either until we looked at this postal map. I've got somebody in India who's preparing a group of letters for the man who was the leading English scholar in India at the time. And he went on a pilgrimage to England in 51. And again, to be able to map their locations as he traveled by sea to get to England. We have lots of languages. They're not all represented as well as English and French, but there's no reason why they can't have better representation. The Indian scholar I just mentioned is providing Tamil. Pointed at the machine. So some of the things we're working on ourselves developing and would like anybody who's interested to find a way of collaborating with us, if you're interested. Faceted searching, everybody will be aware of what that is. That will be active as of the end of July this year. We'll have faceted searching in the project. We did some LDA analysis of words within the collection, and we're quite amazed at how it grouped categories together. This isn't a copy, obviously, of one that we did. And methods of word analysis. We already have, with the Oxford Text Archive, a relationship with Voyant Tools. This is part of a visualization that Stanford did with our data, Voltaire location vectors, both received and sent, which can be quite interesting. So we want full-text searching in the LOTA and the division of it into meaningful chunks. word class and semantic tags in EE, we don't have that. That would be quite interesting to develop. Citation and quotation recognition. I had a postdoctoral student, Glenn Rowe, who did an analysis of Voltaire letters, a subset of Voltaire letters, against Artful at Chicago's collection of French novels from the 18th century, and threw up a lot of really interesting links. Of course, there's no standardized form of making citations and references in those days, but they're all over the place in the letters. We need to find ways of identifying them and structuring them. One of the things that came up that was interesting when we were playing around is discovering that despite his anti-religious fame, Voltaire quotes the Bible almost twice as much as anything else in his letters. And the shaping and pattern of referencing, what kind of stylistic associations are there or could be made based on people's profession, location, gender? We're just chatting with Pavel before about, you know, do people like, I'm working on an English version of the letters of Erasmus, and while it's the surviving collection is only a subset of what he probably wrote, I assumed that they would have been saved because they were very philosophical and serious letters. But actually, lots of them are filled with really interesting personal details. So I'm sure there's more to be discovered in that area. This is named entity recognition is something we talked about before as a possibility. External references, both internal, cross-references, both internal and external. We've got a colleague at Oxford who's been building Wikidata collections for our people. We have those cross-references run note to note. One of the complications is editors often, instead of rewriting notes and in pre-digital form, didn't have an easy way to repeat notes without having to write them over again. So they keep C letter such and such. In many cases, those could be collapsed or filled out to make better sense of things. So other kinds of recognitions of places and works and people. One of the things I did when my daughter was in high school, she was doing philosophy as one of her classes, and they're reading Descartes and having a difficult time. And I went to the class and did a presentation about Descartes' letters, a particular group of letters between Descartes and Thomas Hobbes passing through the French mathematician Mersenne. And Descartes would write an enclosing letter to Mersenne calling Thomas Hobbes that fat, stupid Englishman and saying all kinds of nasty things about Hobbes. But then with a section that was to be sent on to Hobbes for his comment on their philosophical differences. And at one point in the class, one of the boys put up his hand and said, "I get it," he said, "these guys are just like us." And I thought, my dream of what this kind of thing would do, which is to give that personal sense of these people, is potentially real. To have these young people recognize that these people were just people like them, were thinking and arguing when we're rude and crude. I mean, there's hardly a letter that doesn't have somebody talking about their bowel movements and asking if they have any recommendations of how to improve them and so forth. So rather than starting with that, I ended with that. There's a username and password which will give you access to the end of June to the whole collection if you're interested. The Oxford Text Archive is open, but please take a note of those. Now, I'd like to have a more general conversation if anybody has comments or questions or concerns or objections or...
...10 minutes or 15 minutes for discussion. So...
Sorry.
If anybody has any questions.
Thank you very much. The part with the fees and the access, and I mean, nowadays it's all open access. You were asked by the Mellon Foundation to self-sustain somehow.
So every person and every document has a landing page which gives metadata about that person or that document. If you have subscription, you get to see all the rest of the data that's connected with that, included the edited publication itself. But lots and lots of the material is freely available as well.
Okay.
And if big data, you know, if you have a big data request, you want to do some kind of linguistic analysis, we'll export that data for you to work on and develop, and hopefully to publish some of the results through us as well. We have an anniversarial and a miscellany notebook that publishes articles as well.
But still two questions. One is, how does this subscription model work? I mean, how much do you charge, and do people,
right.
So can you really sustain from what you get?
Yeah, okay. We had a beauty pageant, as you might call it, at the New York Public Library with a whole range of international publishers who were interested in taking on the project. And we ultimately decided on Oxford University Press, partly because they're the biggest academic publisher in the world, but also because it kept any money that we paid them within the university, because they plowed their income back into the university. We have individual subscriptions. Again, you need to apply to OUP. I don't have absolute control over the subscription costs, but personal subscriptions are something like £50 UK a year. Institutional, £1,200, which is, what is that in Czech terms?
Yeah.
But we're really flexible. Like I said, the people from Réunion who have very, very little money approached us about access so they could make proper scholarly annotations to the letters, and I simply told OUP to do that, to give it to them. Does that answer? Our income, as I say, pays for our space, pays for our administration, pays for our staff costs. We pay a license fee to presses who provide content. We're willing to help if you need manuscripts imaged and things like that. If we can help with that, if we can get access, we'll do that. We certainly do for the Bodleian Library, which has tens of thousands of manuscripts.
And so it seems to kind of work out the balance of how much you earn and how much you spend.
Well, within the university, and maybe it's the same here, I'm not sure, but my budget for the projects has to show a slight loss every year. If I show a surplus, they take that money. They don't leave it in the project.
Yeah. Second question is related to that. There is no prospect or thinking towards open access, or as you said, so part of it is anyhow available freely, but some part stays. So you will stick to the subscription model for the time being.
Yeah. Yeah. There is an outright purchase model as well. So some big institutions like Harvard and Yale have given us a huge chunk of money to have forever access to the project.
So I would have a small supplementary question towards this. I'm not, maybe you said that, but very briefly. So what are the parts that basically, let's suppose the open access would be top priority. What would kind of not work? Because I think you mentioned that you also pay some fees to some content owners that you don't control basically all the data.
Yeah.
To make some of it accessible, you have to pay somebody else to license it.
If you gave us a collection of letters of some famous person from Prague, but it had to be open access, all those letters would be open access. Links between the people, places, words, whatever, in those letters to other material that's behind the subscription wall would simply show the landing page for the document. So it would give you metadata about the document, but it wouldn't give you all the content that in that other document.
Because
does that answer?
I think so. I think I understand. Because the content of those other documents, like the facsimiles, belong to some archive.
Yeah.
And you have to pay licensing fees to those archives to publish it online.
Yes. Particularly so with academic publishers. So, you know, I've written contracts for about 30 different international publishers. They own the content. They own the intellectual right, the copyright in the content, particularly in the annotations. We could always retranscribe the letters, and it would be our transcription.
So I'm pretty new to digital humanities, but personally, this is something I was surprised by, in a bad way, because I didn't expect that. But if I understand correctly, it's not only about the originals and facsimiles, but it's also, or maybe mostly, about the new scholarly editions.
Yes.
So when you have critical edition of something, then it's still copyrighted, not because of the underlying material, but because of that editorial part.
Exactly. So,
and you want to have those critical editions because they are important part.
They're important part of the project.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, Cambridge University Press are very keen, and they every time they publish an edition of letters, they send me a copy of the book. And they maintain what we call a moving wall of publication. So their restriction is 3 years. We can prepare it over the course of 3 years. We can't show it until they've had a chance to sell the book. And then after 3 years, we can put it online. But they maintain the copyright. Now, having said that, we've made thousands of changes and corrections in the editions. Because one of the things you do when you digitize lots of content in the humanities, you discover that people have the wrong reference to a manuscript, because we check everything. They have a cross-reference to something, and they reference the wrong annotation. So we've corrected all those things. So one of the issues that scholars using EE face is they have to cite our project. And there's been a great tendency to still, in the humanities, for people to cite the book because it has more gravitas or seriousness about it. But actually, they're quoting the wrong source, because it could be quite different in Electronic Enlightenment. Having said that, we know from the issues arising over Facebook, free data, let's do stuff with free data. There's all kinds of issues come up over that. And one of the reasons that academic books cost money is the effort that goes into the editing and the checking of the scholarship inside them. The imprimatur of excellence and quality costs money. Nothing's for free in life, or very few things.
On that note, I met a similar project called EMLO, and that's exactly the conclusion I came to, that project claims very clearly it's about open access to these things, but in the end, you don't see the original.
No.
Very, very rarely you see the original.
No.
You usually get only the metadata, and then you get redirected to some archive in France that tells you you can come to visit them and see the original. So
we're putting everything online, although there is a cost to doing that. And I have to say, I know EMLO intimately. I'm on its board of directors. One of the big issues that we're facing with EMLO is, how do we keep it going? So we're having conversations right now about how Lives, Letters, and Works, our new development from Electronic Enlightenment and OTA, will be able to help EMLO sustain itself. Because unless you get a government somewhere committing to funding it, how can it maintain itself? It can't. It has no means of doing that. So even if it comes down to us taking on the staff and paying their wages, there may have to be a point. And EMLO is basically creating metadata, catalog metadata about manuscripts. That's what its main project is. And it would work well with us, because it would provide, as we already do, we've got lots of people. We've got about 2,000 people in EE for whom there are no letters in EE at the moment. But we send out notices to academics who are researching in that area, to students saying, you know, feel free, if you want to provide letters, more than happy. Translation is another area. I have students, particularly in America, in graduate translation programs, that are translating letters, and we put those online.
Good. So I'll ask another one and see whether somebody else has other questions in between. So when you mentioned those named entities, those places, and so basically you have now a huge catalog of persons and places that are mentioned.
Yeah.
And you mentioned how many attributes each of those has. You mentioned something like more than 400 attributes of a person.
Yeah.
Could you go a little bit into that? Because I can imagine something like 10 attributes for a person, but I can't really imagine what 400 attributes for a person are.
Well, my thought was, and partly it's my scientific background, I guess, is to get as much usable data elements as possible in something. So we use very, very few instances of full text elements or descriptions for some aspect of a person. So their first name is in a field for first names, and the dates are broken down by day, month, year, and time structure. So if we have letters, let's say, rather than people, but if we have letters, several letters by the same person on the same time, same day, we have a time stamp as well that is argued about to indicate which person, which letter comes in which sequence. So for people, every kind of job description gets a categorical label. We've got 750 different occupational labels for people. There's probably too many, but... So information about person's birthplace isn't captured as it is in EMLO, let's say, just as Prague, Czechia, Europe. We would have historical forms of the name as well. Each one of those goes in a field classified as a type of particular element for that person.
Yeah, that was exactly my next question about the names, if you have various historical names of locations and so on. Because that seems to be a big problem, especially with place names, identifying place names, because their names change in time.
Indeed. What we don't do is automatically show for a given document or person on that particular day. We don't have a mechanism at the moment that shows which form of the name their location was, or even their own title if they were an aristocrat, let's say, on that date. We have all that information, but we've never put together a system of displaying it, and we need to do that. I mean, when we first presented this to Oxford University Press, we had a lot more information and data accessible and usable, but they said it was too complicated for most users. So we had to scale back, and we gradually have increased that over time. But
okay, more questions?
You've shown that there is a lot of manual work and that you are sort of heading towards trying to use more automatic methods in name recognition and stuff. Could you just give a estimate of the ratio of manual work and what you can already automate right now?
Right. 99.9% manual. It's one of the reasons I was so excited to meet Pavel when he was talking in Oxford about some of the things that you're doing here. I'm very keen to see how we can use some of the techniques and abilities that you're developing with this kind of data. And I'm really open to us finding, I don't care what area of it you find potentially interesting, go for it. You know, it doesn't have to, I'm not going to insist that we only work on people first or something else. I mean, whatever is interesting is what should be pursued. But at the moment, yes, it's manual work.
Okay, more questions? Okay.
I mean, our colleague who ran some Wikidata results for people, he tried automatic matching and got 20% matches. It's that difficult to do, actually.
So my next question would be towards this exactly. So Have you tried, you know, are you using some of that data in those rich databases, for instance, in your search interface? So if I search for, I don't know, London, does it show me all the various names that, you know, does it show me all the occurrences of London in the data, even though it is used with a, you know, quoted with a different name and so on?
At the moment, we don't show all the forms. We would show all the documents that have a form of the name, and you'd have to take it from the document. But at the moment, we haven't run out the list of forms.
Oh, okay, so it will show me documents that are quoted under, I don't know,
yeah,
different name, but it will not group those documents by the form and so
on. No, I see. And that's something we would like to see done.
Okay, but the most important step is there, that if I look for Voltaire, it will show me all the occurrences of Voltaire, even the places where he is quoted mm-hmm. in a different name, if it was annotated as that.
Yes, yeah.
Okay. How much of this annotation is there in the data?
Now that
I start thinking about, you know, amount of training data.
Yeah. There's about 450,000 scholarly annotations.
And those would be mostly these identified entities from the database?
The annotations could be anything. I mean, some of them are as long as an essay discussing some aspect of the letter that it's attached to. In other cases, it's simply mentioning a mark on the manuscript that demonstrates some brain damage or something.
I see. So do you have some estimation of the number of, you know, entities, people, and places, and so on, annotated? How many occurrences of these?
I've personally been working on trying to identify biblical and classical quotations using names of the books of the Bible or main classical authors, let's say. And I've come up with tens of thousands of annotations for both. And it's example, the citation instance is a good example, because a lot of times what editors have done is they've said Virgil Aeneid 4:1, and that's it. Now, maybe you know Virgil's Aeneid well enough to know exactly what's being quoted or what the context of that quote is, but not everybody who comes to our project is going to know that. So what we want to do is be able to flesh that out in an automated fashion if it's possible. But I've been doing it manually just to demonstrate what's needed.
A comment on the question of the named entities. And so what I see on the page, on the front page, it's saying the update from autumn 2017 that the total collection of the bibliographical dictionary is 10,000 entries. So do I understand correctly that you have kind of 10,000 different entities?
We've actually got 11,000 because I've added 1,000 since that.
Order of magnitude.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. So it's in the realm of 10,000 entities and hundreds of thousands of mentions of those entities.
Yeah.
That's quite substantial data.
Yeah.
Okay. More questions? I don't want to be the only one asking most.
And there's lots of entities to identify, like I say, works, literary works, or references to literary works, to events, you know, to certain battles and so forth. And again, you'd need to build a structure, because how they refer to it in all the different languages, and also depending on whether they have colloquial terms for the piece. They might just refer to the piece. And what you need to do is look at the letter date and try and work out in historical terms what piece they're talking about and why it's making a big difference in that person's life.
So how many of those, do you have some estimation, how many of those entities in your database are linked to other databases, like Wikipedia or WIAF for people or whatever else?
VF, we've got probably about 5,000 people connected.
So that would be more than half of the people that you have in there,
yeah,
right?
The rest of them have to go through a very official submissions process. So we have to approach Bodleian Library's cataloging department, who have to construct a Library of Congress authority file entry for them, and then they have to submit it to the Library of Congress and negotiate its acceptance into the new authority list. Luckily, as part of the Bodleian Library, we can do that, but
it's
a process.
So you are taking some effort into linking to existing libraries. So whenever people, annotators, think about starting new, I don't know, event or entry for a person or something, they look up the other databases, they look up Wikipedia, whether there is an entry, and if there is, then you link it.
Yeah.
Okay. That's pretty important step in the automatic identification of the entities. Anyone else? Then I think we have to end the seminar now. Robert is here for the rest of the afternoon. We'll be discussing somewhere in the corridor or somewhere around. Mm. Feel free to look us up if you have
Indeed.
Something important. There's also tomorrow the Daria workshop, Daria Czech workshop at the main building of Academy of Sciences. Robert will be there also, so you can attend the workshop. You can still see him during tomorrow. Thank you very much for coming,
and thank
you for having me. Thank Robert once again.
Thank you.